Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.Buddham Dhammam Sangham Namassami. This time last week I was traveling to Michigan. We got a few messages that a friend of the monastery, Surakamon, was very, very seriously ill. She'd been ill for a while, but things were seemed to be caving in, so I had to travel at short notice to Michigan to go and see her and to lend some moral support and help her and the family along. And you know, during that time, being in the hospital, visiting her, and then seeing her very grave condition with many, many tubes and wires kind of in her arms and in her body, and a ventilator in her throat, and unable to move, just basically lying in bed, could move her hands a bit but couldn't speak. And seeing this very dire and delicate condition, body in a state of extreme sickness, and then just also being around in the hospital and seeing other people also experiencing that kind of various extremes of physical difficulty, stress, disease, one kind or another. And then I spent a couple of days in Michigan, then had to fly back in time to visit the local Waldorf school last Tuesday, and then a group of the same pupils and the teachers and parents came here yesterday. So going from the hospital and the realm of sickness and aging to the realm of youth and vital activity, kids bouncing around, high octane energy, a lot of activity and enthusiasm, exuberance, but also just the sheer amount of effort needing to sort of contain and protect and guide and steer the human form in its at the beginning of its life. Yeah, in the beginning of our times, and just reflecting on these different qualities, what it takes to protect and support and hold a human life together, it's pretty incredible, Ray, whether we're old and sick or kind of at least temporarily able-bodied and independent in our sort of the illusion of adult competence and and independent activity that we have in the middle bit for some of us some of the time. And then the early part of the life of a young child, moving towards independence and learning how to contain and guide and use useful energy and in a skillful way and protect and help the young body to develop. And reflecting on this, just considering what it takes to hold a human life together and into some degree of coordinated, composed, integrated activity, that's incredible, really. The amazingly delicate and intricate, fragile system. When you consider it, all the things that have to be in place in order to hold it all together, it's a staggering array, huge, complex, hyper-complex array of of different influences and forces and supports and protections. Just like seeing Suripon in her bed in the hospital with these a couple of dozen tubes and wires and machines and bags of this and that and the other, fluid coming in her arms, in her throat, up her nose. You know, it's just keeping one human body alive in a state of illness and advanced infection, keeping it going and doing the best to enable the body to survive. So when you consider this, or we look at this in a direct way and really open the mind, open the heart to that, I see, yeah, it's an amazing number of conditions have to all be lined up and be in order for our life to be sustained. It's an incredible number of conditions have to be coordinated to help us just to make it through a day. And when we consider that delicacy, that intricacy, that dependency, then it's hardly surprising that things don't work perfectly all the time. You know, that things get out of control. You know, the kid's emotions get a bit awry, or somebody gets upset, or the pancreas starts to cave in, or the white blood cell starts ramping up because of infection. You know, the heart rate goes down, or the parent loses their grip. It's a very, very finely balanced system, you know, all the way along, from even before birth, all the way to the last breath. And even as the body after death is decaying, the whole process of decaying is also an intricate and well-ordered system. So it's when we consider this, really open the heart, open the mind to the fact of this, then it changes our view of things, really, and that we see that it's more a kind of drunkenness or hubris that we would look upon our life with the idea that we've got the right to be comfortable and happy and healthy and free to go about our business and do whatever we choose, you know, all the days of our life. We realize that's an absurdity. It's just impossible. Yeah, just from the time of our birth, you know, then it's, you know, the whole period of our childhood and adolescence, we're not in any kind of full state of understanding or control or reliable guidance. And then there's this little bit of the adult life where we have the majority of people have the sort of maximal competence and independence, and then that doesn't last too long before things start waning and the hearing starts to go and the thinking starts to go and vitality starts to go, and then, you know, sliding down to you know, everything packing in and nothing kind of working terribly well, and eyes, ears, mobility, taste, thinking, yeah, all starts to cave in and go its natural way, because it can't just stay coordinated for so long, and then degenerating. And when we look at it, we think, well, of course, how could it be otherwise? But we live in this state of hubris where we think we've got the right to be, you know, independent and happy and comfortable all day, every day. It's crazy, really, that we should, you know, ever think that like that. And then we find ourselves being startled or shocked when something gets in the way, when we have an injured limb, or we have a headache or a cold, or someone has a gripe against us, or crick our back moving the furniture or something, and it's, oh, how can this be? Oh, this is how inconvenient. Oh, this is not fair. This isn't right. It shouldn't be this way. So it's all of these reasons. When we gather all of this together, we realize why the Buddha encouraged the reflections on old age, sickness and death. I think it was just this morning that we, at the end of the morning chanting, we did the recitation of the five subjects for frequent recollection. I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I am the owner of my karma, related to my karma, born of my karma. Abide supported by my karma, whatever karma I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. Now, sometimes when people see these in the chanting book or they hear that, they think, wow, this is really depressing. I mean, these guys really like to be miserable. I mean, life is bad enough already. Why do we have to make ourselves even, you know, more glum and moody and negative about the whole thing? But what we're doing with those reflections is more like waking the mind up to get with the program. Like, this is the deal. This is what we sign when we're born. Is that this is the order of things, the natural order of things, and that rather than it being depressing, that when we see, oh, this is the way it's supposed to be. Yeah, of course, you know, that we get born and then we go through infancy and we acquire all kinds of illnesses and build up immunities of various kinds because of having those illnesses, and then we slowly learn to make our way around and develop some independence. But we've got to live in communication with other people, we've got to feed the body, we've got to live in varieties of climates and weathers, different seasons. The body's got a damageable skin, it feels pleasure and pain. Of course we're going to fall over and scratch ourselves, of course we're going to collide with other people. Of course there's going to be obstructions and difficulties and things that we don't want or don't choose. How could it be otherwise? You know, when we just stop and think about it, reflect on it for a moment, it's really extremely obvious. So with these reflections, what we're doing is encouraging ourselves to recognize, well, it's always been this way. There's nothing that's out of order just because we get ill. The body is an intricate, you know, and massively complex organic system. Of course, things have to go awry every so often. Yeah, our body's a food source. It's a whole environment. It's a massive ecosystem. So if some little bacteria or microbe or virus finds a way to get in and make merry and use us as a food source, well, of course it's going to. Yeah, we do that all the time ourselves. The whole agricultural industry is based on taking advantage of the ecosystem. That's what the viruses are doing. That's what the bacteria are doing. It says, oh, look, there's a way in. You know, quick, distract the antibodies for a while. Sneak around the back door. Come in. Quick, before she takes some ibuprofen, you know, takes the antibiotics and make merry, multiply. And then the side effect is producing illness and difficulty or pain for the host. But as far as the little critters are concerned, it's like, hey, we really made good here. We got our own little project going. We had our whole civilization managed to be hatched, to grow, blossom, reach its peak and demise. And just like our own empires and civilizations on the human scale we think of as glorious and colorful or traumatic in various ways. Similarly, just our own body. It's like an environment that other smaller creatures are similarly developing their empires and civilizations, growing up, doing their thing, fading away and dying. We call it having a cold or having an infection or a sore spot. To the at the bacterial level, it can be a whole eon is arising and passing. You know, and you may think, well, this is all a little bit stretched or far-fetched or absurd, but it's the fact, really, when you think about it. If you take a microscope and look at your skin, it's absolutely shocking. The whole bacterial colonies of all incredible varieties, very colourful, impressive. Just look, take a scraping from under your fingernail. Even when you think your fingernails are clean, there's whole the whole civilizations down there. So we're an ecosystem. The body is an ecosystem. We think of it as an individual, but it's just a sub-ecosystem. You know, it's a sub-totality in a larger complex of ecosystems. So it's in a state of change, and sometimes the consciousness at our human level is going to be comfortable, sometimes uncomfortable. How could it be otherwise? So these reflections on I am of the nature to age, I am of the nature to sicken, I am of the nature to die, all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, and so on. Reflections on karma, its result. These are all pointing us to this simple reality. It's because of ignorance, because of wrong view, seeing things incorrectly, that we get carried away by the false impressions of independence and permanence and stability and the right to be comfortable, the right to not be opposed, or the right to be happy, the right to be surrounded by likable objects. We see that's a childlike delusion that we can go around influenced by, but as long as we are influenced by that, as long as we buy into that, then we're continually in a state of stress and difficulty. The world is always going wrong. It's always an invasion or an intrusion or an obstruction. That I have this illness, or this person's in my way, or that the weather's not doing what I want, or the nail is not obeying my hammer. And we take it all personally. So it's kind of ridiculous, in a way. So that when we use these reflections and apply them in a clear and systematic way, then it serves to be an illuminating presence for the habits of self-view, personality view, sakkaya ditti. Because it's really the cause, that's the cause of our reactivity or our feeling of being affronted or obstructed or alienated through those kind of attachments. Yeah. When meeting with sickness or death or losing things that we love or people that we love, feeling that we can create karma and not experience a result, or not create karma and wanting to experience a result, and so on. That's all deriving from self-view, the belief that I am the body, I am the personality, this is me, this is who I am, this is myself. If you think about it, if you reflect on it, that's exactly what these reflections are and contemplations are pointing right at. It's only if there's the belief I am the body, then I'm of the nature to age. The body is of the nature to age. The mind doesn't really have any age at all, essentially. The body is of the nature to sicken. Also the conditioned mind, on the level of personality or mental faculties, they can also sicken. Mental illness is a fact. Disordered or confused, chaotic emotions and thoughts and feelings, scrambled perceptions, that certainly happens in nature. And death is part of the system. Certainly the body, this integrated form, has to disintegrate. And at a certain point the breath will stop and the integration will cease and disintegration will take over. That's the natural order. But if the body is not self, feelings are not self, perceptions are not self, mental formations are not self, consciousness is not self, then what's to be lost? Who is it that's being endangered? Who is losing anything? Who is it that's separated from the loved? Who is the recipient of the results of good and bad action? Right? It's only because of sakkaya ditti, of self-view, that there's a sting in any of that. If I am the body, then if the body gets sick, then I'm sick. If there's self-view, if there's no self-view, then there's sickness in the body, but so what? It's not self. You know, you take some medicine or give it a rest, you can do what's necessary for it, but it's not who and what we are. If someone says this body is attractive or unattractive, so this body is old or young, this body is beautiful or ugly, this body is heavy or light, this body is female or male, this body is old, young, middle-aged. So what? It has a value. You know, maybe there's a pride at being a certain age or a certain strength or a certain gender. But that's totally based on self-view, isn't it? When we let go of self-view, when the heart abandons that ignorant perception, I am the body, I am the personality, I am the mind, when that's seen through for what it is, then there's a tremendous relief. So these reflections are helping to arouse that brightness, that clarity of the heart that illuminates those ignorant views. It illuminates those deluded habits of attitude. And then those delusions can be seen through. Their transparency can be revealed. Because in truth, in the ultimate truth of things, you know, that we're not the body, we're not the personality. I'm not in ultimate truth. I'm not male. I'm not female. I'm not a monk. I'm not a layperson. I'm not a person. None of us are really. It's just a strong evidence. There is clues that make them that. Make us reach that deduction, lead us to that conclusion. But as Perry Mason back in the day would say, it's merely circumstantial evidence. It's only circumstantial evidence. Okay, there's a body, there's a personality, there's a social security number, there's a birth certificate. This is merely circumstantial evidence. There's no absolute proof whatsoever. It's just bits of evidence being woven together and false assumptions are being made, false deductions are being made. So then, you know, when these things are said, we hear these kind of Dhamma teachings and you say, oh yeah, right, but listen, I'm a guy, I'm not a woman, I'm a man. I'm a woman, I'm not a man. I'm a monk, I'm definitely a monk, I'm not a layperson anymore, I'm a monk. That's self-view, isn't it? Yeah. Ultimately, there aren't any men, there aren't any women here. There are no monastics, no lay people. There's nobody who's old, nobody who's young, nobody who's tall or short, nobody who's sick or healthy. These are the impressions that form and are woven together through attachment and ignorance that we make. This I who's an individual, separate entity. That's definitely the appearance of things, but it can't be the whole truth, can it? And this isn't just a kind of proclaimed assertion coming from somebody sitting up in the front seat. But these are things to investigate for ourselves. You know, the Buddha's path is one of analysis, of exploration, of Vibhajyavada, the way of analysis, of exploration, of investigation, vibhajja. So we look into, is that the case? Isn't this the case? Which part of me is male? Okay, we have the body, it's a male body, but how far down do you go? Down to the cellular level? Yeah, well, there's kind of X and Y chromosomes there at the cellular level. Okay, well, down inside the chromosomes, inside that, the X and the Y, down inside the, you know, the Y chromosome, the male chromosome. Okay, is the carbon and nitrogen, hydrogen, phosphorus, yeah, sulfur and potassium, sodium making up that chromosome? Adenine, guanine, cytosine and thymine all woven together in the little spirals in the DNA. Is that male carbon, or is that is the hydrogen masculine hydrogen? My body is solely made of masculine hydrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, sulfur, sodium, calcium, potassium. These are strictly male protons, neutrons, electrons. It's absurd, isn't it? Totally ridiculous. Only have, our body is only made of female quarks, female electrons, nuclear forces. It's absurd. Masculinity, femininity begins as a conventional designation somewhere up the scale, but at the root, it's just subatomic particles buzzing around, woven together with the energy of the universe. That's all. There's no ultimate old or young, monastic or layperson, female or male, good or bad, beautiful or ugly, tall or short, heavy or light. It can't be. It's just not there. So when we take these kind of reflections and apply them, then they help to illuminate that in us which says, but I am. I am a person. That what it does, it reveals that, yes, there's this very clear and definite feeling that arises that says, I am a person. But that arises, does its thing, and ceases. It's a transient phenomenon. That's all. It's a very convincing feeling. That's all. The feeling of perception of being a monastic or a layperson, a visitor, a resident, old or young, of a particular nationality, a particular personality type, being shy or being extrovert, competent or incompetent, a success or a failure, healthy or sick. Those are convincing perceptions, but they arise, they cease. What is it that knows them? What is it that owns them? So we use the power of these reflections, ways of investigating our experience, ways of looking at our assumptions, the habitual ways of viewing things, to help that I am habit to be truly seen, sakkaya ditti. And so we see as we apply that and develop the insight meditation and develop vipassana and this path of investigation, the practice of really looking, letting that wisdom faculty truly illuminate and look, explore. Open everything up, take a look inside it, exploring inside the perceptions and thoughts, assumptions, attitudes. And we see all the different layers of identification that go on. So the coarsest levels of identification with the physical body or aspects of, and attitudes, but it can get subtler and subtler. What we think and what the I am attaches to. So maybe we, as a seeing through, I'm not the body. Maybe that was just a foolish delusion I was laboring under, but I'm not really the body. What I am, I'm pure awareness. That's what I am. I'm the one who knows. I am the clear awareness that illuminates all conditions. Yeah, that's what I am. And we don't, and that's in a way maybe an advance on believing I'm a person, or I'm old, or I'm young, or I'm tall, or I'm short, fat or thin, man or woman. But it's still an I am. It's still sakkaya ditti. It's still self-view. The I am this. The mind taking hold of a concept, buying into it, and being born into that, taking birth in that. Even very abstruse or refined kinds of identification. Looking at the at our nature, or who and what we are, in very sort of expansive or non-personal ways. Yeah, I am the energy of the universe, or my essential nature is an intricate, symmetrical, organic web of 196,844 different dimensions. That's what I am. That's the real me. And that's pretty mind-blowing, isn't it? The fundamental fabric of the universe, not just three dimensions or four, or even stretching the mind out into the subatomic realms of 11 dimensions or 23 dimensions, but 196,844 different dimensions, all perfectly arranged and interrelating and in awesome symmetry. Wow. But it's still an I am, isn't it? That's still there's still self-view, even weaving itself into a mind-boggling concept like that. It still generates the illusion of individual existence. So this is why the Buddha pointed to the reality of things through the teaching on anatta. This is like the most brilliant and helpful practical of teachings. Because even though you can use the I am language in a transcendent or liberating way, it's so easy for the ignorant kinds of I am, Sakkaya Ditti, Asmimana, to grab hold of that and take it over, so it stops being a sort of transcendent I, but then is co-opted to be taken as in a personal and an alienating way, even in subtle, almost invisible forms. So the teaching on anatta is continually pointing the heart towards that of relinquishment. That, as the Buddha said, yena yena hi manyanti tato tanghoti anyatati. Whatever you conceive it to be, the reality is always other than that. Whatever we conceive it to be, even if we conceive that our true nature is an intricate matrix of 196,844 dimensions woven together in shimmering organic perfection, the reality is always other than that. So that any kind of construct, any kind of concept, any kind of idea, then the Buddha is saying it can't be that. The reality can't be formed even into the most intricate and delicate, all-encompassing of concepts. Because it's a concept, it's a form, it's a structure. And the Dhamma is always beyond form, beyond construction. Asankata, unformed, uncompounded. So therefore anything that's compounded or formed can't truly represent that truth, that reality. No matter how vast or all-encompassing it might seem to be. So the teachings on anatta are always simply pointing us to letting go, to relinquishment, to abandonment, to non-identification with any form, any structure. And then it's a very, very simple process, because if that's simply followed, if we take that to heart and cultivate that non-attachment, non-identification with the body, with feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, then the reality, the truth is revealed. The truth can be realized. The Dhamma can be realized. As soon as you try to conceive that truth, conceive the reality, then we lose it. As soon as we try to define that Dhamma, that ultimate reality as a concept, we lose it. We're lost, we're stuck. We're born alienated and caught in that trap once again. The heart is sending up illusory barriers and hiding itself behind those. So the teaching on anatta is not a belief, it's not a philosophy of, I don't exist or there is no self. What it's saying is that all that we can conceive, all that we can perceive or name, that's not who and what we are. When we let go of what we're not, then what is real will become apparent. That's all it takes. Just let go of what we're not, and then what's true is what's left. What's true will be revealed. But as soon as the desire mind, the grasping mind jumps on that, then you're back in the I am pure awareness. I am the one who knows. I am the wisdom mind. I am the pure heart. And it buys into that, and then we're caught up, carried away, swept along on the tide of becoming once again. So it's a resting in that relinquishment, resting in that attitude of non-grasping. And that's really frustrating to the thinking mind, to the grasping mind, because we like to define what we are. I am a man, I am a woman, I'm a monk, I'm a layperson, I'm old, I'm young, I'm useless, I'm fine, I'm better. We like, the desire mind likes those I ams, even though they create alienation and insecurity. They're the generators of dukkha, of imbalance and discontent. But they're the devil that we know, so that's where the mind likes to go. So it takes a lot of courage and resilience to train the heart to rest in that space of non-grasping, of non-becoming, of relinquishment. But if we allow that, then we find a tremendous ease, a spaciousness and completeness that can never be found when the I ams are bought into, are believed in. It takes a moment of applying that strength and resolution to not allow the heart to be swept into that becoming. But having survived that wave, of having let the wave pass, there's a tremendous quality of relief and ease. And this is one of the other things that's useful to reflect on in this respect, is that lack of definition. We should expect it to be frustrating to the thinking mind. So much of spiritual practice and the development of the spiritual path is training the heart to be at ease with that undefinability, that unapprehendability. It's difficult to do, but if we don't train the heart to rest in that undefined, unapprehendable quality, to be that, then there'll always be the habits of looking for another thing to be, another project to absorb into, another place to go to, another future to get born into. We're never able to fulfill the goal of going forth, or entering upon the spiritual path, because there's always going to be another thing for me to be, a place for me to go, a thing for me to get rid of, a thing for me to acquire, a thing for me to become, a thing for me to abandon. Viable, you can make a case for any of that, to become more concentrated, to go live in a different monastery, to launch a new book project, to build a new structure, to develop more insight, to get more concentration, to recover my health. All good and wonderful things, but the becoming mind grabs hold of that and uses it to evade the unapprehendable, this quality of undefined presence, unlocated presence, that knowing of the heart, which is the true Buddha mind, the knowing heart, the Buddha nature. It becomes a token of spiritual qualities and obscures the fact that at that moment of becoming, going to a new place, getting a new thing, becoming better, we're missing the reality of what it's all for. We're obscuring that, burying that. So training the heart to be at ease with that is difficult, but it's important to have this in mind, to be recollecting that. And when the Buddha talked about his own nature, when he referred to himself, he used the word Tathagata, the one who has thus come, thus gone. Tathagata. Gone to thusness. Tathagata. One who has arrived at thusness, suchness. That's undefined. There's definitely something there or here. But what is it? Is it totally here? Is it totally gone? Gone to suchness, come to suchness. What does that mean? So it's a brilliant term. The Buddha seems to have coined it himself. It's a brilliant symbol. Because there's a definite something, but it's not quite a thing, or it's more than a thing. And is it come? Is it gone? Is it here? Is it there? There's an undefinedness to it, an edgelessness to it, an unlocatedness to it, that evokes that very principle. It's just like then the famous exchange between the Buddha and the monk Anuradha, and you know, Anuradha had been asked by some other Brahmins, some other spiritual practitioners, you know, what does your teacher say happens to an enlightened being at the death of the body? Do they exist? Do they not exist? Do they both exist or not exist? Do they neither exist nor not exist? And then Anuradha says that Tathagata describes the nature of an enlightened one after the death of the body apart from those four instances. So it's something other than those four possibilities. They reappear, they don't reappear, they both reappear and not reappear, they neither reappear nor not reappear. So then Anuradha goes to the Buddha, and well, they think, well, you must be either someone who's stupid or newly ordained, because that's no kind of an answer at all. You're just evading the question. You know, it's got to be one of those four. I mean, that's pretty thorough. So then he goes to the Buddha and recounts the conversation and says, did I answer in the right way? And the Buddha qualifies his response and goes and engages in this dialogue with Anuradha. And so he says to him, Anuradha, can you say that the Tathagata is the five khandhas? Form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness? No, Venerable Sir. Can you say that the Tathagata is not the five khandhas? No, Venerable Sir. Can you say that the Tathagata is in the five khandhas? No, Venerable Sir. Can you say that the Tathagata is apart from the five khandhas? No, Venerable Sir. Can you say that the Tathagata has the five khandhas? Form, feeling, perception, mental formations, consciousness. No, Venerable Sir. Can you say that the Tathagata does not have the five khandhas? No, Venerable Sir, you cannot say that. So, in those three different dimensions, being, not being, inside, outside, having, not having, if the Tathagata is not definable in any of those ways. So then the Buddha says, so, Anuradha, even though the Tathagata is standing here before you, still the Tathagata is unapprehendable here and now, even while the body is here before you. So, how much more so is that, is an enlightened being indescribable? After the passing away of the body, you can't fix it, you can't name it, you can't say anything about it. You know, all words fall flat at that boundary. So it's mind-boggling, isn't it? You know, that, and you might think the Buddha is just sort of is drawn into, you know, this fond of sophistry and trying to be clever and can outsmart everybody else. But these are serious and useful principles to contemplate. And so what is that quality of our own nature, the Tathagata, that which is thus come, thus gone, got that which is of the nature of suchness, that ultimate nature of reality, that you can't take a position in relationship to the body, feelings, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, that you can't define it in those terms or apart from those terms. It's frustrating to the thinking mind, to the conceiving mind. But just as the Buddha said, even though the Tathagata is right here before you, Anuradha, you can't define that quality in terms of the conditioned and the formed, of the born. It's not definable in those terms. But there's something. There's a very, very definite something. So the heart has to just open up and the thinking mind collapse. That's the fundamental mixture. The thinking mind just says, I give up. But the heart is then opens and is awake and can know that very quality, that very suchness. The heart can open to that, know that, awaken to that, be that. And it's often only when the thinking mind shuts up and says, okay, I'm cashing my chips here. I'm out of my depth. I give up. Then the heart can go, right. Right, here it is. This is it. Ah. And that quality of suchness can be known. So it is, it's mystifying or frustrating to the thinking mind, but we should accept that. And it's also important to recognize that just because something is inconceivable or doesn't make sense, doesn't mean to say that it's not real. A little while ago, I was contemplating in the realm of mathematics. Those of you who remember your high school math and particularly complex numbers, how the square root of minus one does not, in conceptual ordinary three-dimensional reality, exist. There is no square root of minus one. You can't multiply. There's no two numbers that you can multiply together. No two ordinary real numbers that you can multiply together to get minus one. However, somebody a few hundred years ago had the idea of, well, if there was a square root of minus one, how would that behave if you started, you know, running a few equations with it and putting it here and putting it there and carrying out different operations? Well, it just turns out, rather like this other principle, that even though the square root of minus one doesn't actually exist, there are various qualities in nature that depend upon the existence of the square root of minus one. For example, the Hewlett-Packard Empire. Hewlett and Packard, one of their first inventions that they patented and got launched their company on was what something called a phase shift oscillator, which was used by Disney in his early days for doing various photographic trickeries. So that when you describe a circuit for a phase shift oscillator, it depends upon the presence of the square root of minus one. That the only way you can make that circuit work is if that quality is present. However, the square root of minus one doesn't exist. Yet, they've built a $40 billion fortune on that very same quality. It's pretty mysterious, but also pretty tangible. I mean, I even have a Hewlett-Packard laptop. So I'm not just saying this to just kind of come up with weird and wonderful factoids or suppositions, but this is the fact. you ask anybody who's been involved in electronic engineering, and they say it's true. There's certain circuits that depend on the square root of minus one, and the fact is that in nature that can't really exist. There is no number that exists in the normal sense. However, it's there. It has an actuality. There's effects that it produces, even though it doesn't exist. So it struck me as how similar this is to the unapprehendability of the Tathagata. There and not there, real and not real, totally present. If you imagine yourself being face to face with the Buddha, but yet the Buddha then, recognizing that the Tathagata is trackless, is unfathomable, is ungraspable, even though the being, the presence is right there before you, is still untraceable, untouchable, undefinable. So it's when we open the mind and drop our habitual patterns of thinking, drop the need for rational definition, drop the habits of casting the world into our preferred and unconscious biases. We let that fall down. We let that those habits of conception fall flat, and open up the heart. Then that quality of suchness can truly be known. The Tathagata nature can be known, can be embodied, even though the thinking mind can't conceive it. This is something that we can do, and even though it's maybe referring to various abstruse concepts or things that seem intangible, the result of this, just like the presence of the Buddha, the result is very far from intangible. The result is that of immense peacefulness and beauty, clarity and simplicity that we can know. That is the very nature of this heart. It can be known, and that this is possible for us. There's the opportunity is always here for this to be awakened to. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening.
Andamayam namakataya sarukaram dharamase sarukaram.